You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, from Beijing to Berlin, we'll discuss the day's top news stories with journalists Jeffrey Kaufman and Tim Marshall right here in the studio. We'll also speak to Azar Nafisi, author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, about her new book, The Republic of Imagination. We'll check in with our woman in Athens, and we'll do an art review from Sao Paulo. That's all coming up on Midori House right now with me, Andrew Muller. An action-packed 59 minutes and 5 seconds ahead of us. But before all that, Paul Osborne has the latest world news.
A woman has been stabbed to death in the West Bank hours after an Israeli soldier was badly injured in another knife attack in Tel Aviv. The woman was attacked near a Jewish settlement south of Jerusalem. The attacker was shot by a security guard. A Palestinian man's been arrested over the assault on the soldier. The stabbings are the latest in a series of attacks targeting Israelis in the past fortnight, raising tensions in the country. Two people, including the attacker in Jerusalem, were injured. Asher Salmon is a doctor at the Hadassah in Karem Medical Center.
We just received the two casualties. One was stabbed in the abdomen and he is now under evaluation, seems to be quite severely injured. And we got also the terrorist, which has a shot wound in his chest, and we are evaluating the situation just now.
The leaders of Albania and Serbia have argued publicly about the status of Kosovo after talks that were meant to signal a new era in relations between the two. Adi Rama was the first Albanian prime minister to visit Belgrade for nearly 70 years. At a news conference in the city, he called on Serbia to formally recognise the independence of Kosovo.
We have two entirely different positions on Kosovo, but the reality is one and unchangeable. Kosovo has been recognised now by more than 108 countries. Its independence was also recognised by the International Court of Justice, and it is a European regional reality.
But Serbia's Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić said he would not allow his country to be humiliated, saying Mr. Rama's comments were a provocation. At least 48 people have been killed in a suicide bomb attack on a school in the northeast of Nigeria. 79 others were injured. Police say the attacker was disguised as a student. The bomb went off as pupils at the school in Potiskum had gathered for an assembly. No groups admitted being behind the attack, but the Islamist Boko Haram has attacked schools in the region in the past. A memorial service has taken place in Amsterdam 4 months after a Malaysia Airlines plane was shot out of the sky over eastern Ukraine. Almost two-thirds of the 298 people on board were from the Netherlands. Ukraine and Western countries accuse pro-Russian rebels of shooting down the plane with a Russian-made missile. But Vladimir Putin has again said today that allegation is totally unfounded. The leaders of Japan and China have shared an apparently uncomfortable public handshake after their first direct talks. Shinzo Abe and Xi Jinping met on the sidelines of a major summit in Beijing. The talks were arranged after 2 years of worsening relations over disputed islands in the East China Sea. Alessio Patilano, a lecturer in war studies at King's College London, calls it a significant breakthrough.
Certainly the handshake was an awkward handshake, a very unhappy faces. But at the end of the day, what is important is that the meeting took place at all. The importance is that actually something that very few would have hoped to see happening actually happened. So in this respect, there is a glimpse of a cautious optimism.
A jihadist group behind a series of attacks on Egyptian security forces has reportedly pledged allegiance to the group Islamic State. Ansar Beit al-Maqdis was behind a number of attacks in Sinai since Egypt's military overthrew the former president Mohamed Morsi last year. Dozens of troops were killed in an attack on a checkpoint last month. State media in Syria says the president, Bashar al-Assad, is considering a UN proposal for localized ceasefires in the country. The plan was suggested by the UN mediator Stefan de Mistura, who suggested the city of Aleppo was the obvious first location for what he's called incremental freeze zones. It's hoped the local ceasefires, if successful, could be expanded as a way of ending Syria's civil war. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Paul. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is coming up for 18.06, which will be 13.06 in New York. We have at last returned to the proper time differential rather than that annoying one that exists for 2 hours, 2 weeks or so. So it ruins everything for about 2 weeks every year and just confuses people trying to read radio scripts.
You're so inflexible.
Who's the president?
Exactly. Should we all just go out and come back in again? Anyway, joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio, Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor with Sky News, Jeffrey Kaufman, the journalist and commentator. Welcome both. We will start with the APEC summit in Beijing, where Chinese President Xi Jinping and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe have met for talks and been photographed exchanging a handshake. Neither man could have looked less happy to be there if they'd tried. Tim, a diplomatic editor that you are, Japan versus China. How much of this is political theater, and how much do they really just not like each other?
Oh, I have no reason to believe that they dislike each other. However, they've both got populations back home watching the same pictures that we saw. And this, for me, was the best bit of political theatre since Obama met Putin in Northern Ireland last year and they could barely look at each other.
So the classic one where they both look like they're on detention.
Yeah.
And each blaming the other for the fact
was
that
great.
They're there.
Abe, the Japanese leader, is there first. In comes Xi. And Abe's translator, he says hello in Japanese. Abe's translator translates whatever it is. And Xi just doesn't even look at him. Doesn't say anything. They shake hands for 15 seconds, and then Xi just walks off, and at no point did he say anything. Now, that is for the domestic audiences back home. But this stuff does matter. I think it's good that they met. I think it's good there's been a pact as well, an economic pact between South Korea, Japan, and China, because they're going to bump up against each other a lot in the next 10 years. So I think it's good that they are speaking and one of them speaking anyway. I think it's good that they're having a relationship because they're going to need that relationship over the next 10 years, and that is the positive of what actually is a rather worrying decade coming up in that part of the world.
It is a fantastic picture. It looked to me like the kind of the meeting out the front of the church between the reluctant groom and the reluctant father-in-law just before one shoves the shotgun in the other one's back and marches him up the aisle.
It actually looked to me like two little kids in sort of fourth grade sort of going, I don't like him and I don't want to have what a sleepover is.
But political fit is so important because Xi is maneuvering China to 6 times out of 10 win every single diplomatic battle. And over the decade, he will change people's perceptions of whose backyard the East China Sea and the South China Sea is. I think he will be successful over a period of a decade by not talking to Abe and looking tough at the theatrical level, but also at a deeper level. He will succeed. The region will think to itself, you know what, maybe this is their backyard. Maybe we shouldn't be too close to the Americans. I think the Chinese are going to win the political theatre war.
Jeffrey, Shinzo Abe said afterwards that the meeting was, and I quote, the first step for improving ties by returning to mutually beneficial relations based on common strategic interests. Now, to the obvious limited extent that means anything whatsoever, what is it?
Well, you know, I think that in the world of diplomacy, that does actually mean something, even though if in the world of a grammarian, it doesn't mean much. It simply means we're talking. And you know, we can be skeptical and we can chortle about it, and it's true. That picture really is unforgettable.
It's a classic.
But you know, we know from history, and that you know, we just celebrated the 100th anniversary of the First World War. You've got to talk to avoid things getting out of hand. And so I'm actually a real believer that even putting them in the same room and having them shake hands is an important accomplishment. And I think, you know, it gets back to the whole nature of what diplomacy is about. And if they don't know each other, if they don't sit face to face, it's much easier to vilify them.
There has been talk of establishing what they called a maritime crisis mechanism. This is
a hotline.
This is, of course, to do with those uninhabited rock piles that they're forever getting in each other's faces about. Jeffrey, I mean, how great is the danger of what people call war by accident between China and Japan?
Gosh, I'm not sure I feel qualified to answer that. I think that those islands, though...
You mentioned 1914, which was the Great War by accident.
Right, right. Which was another unnecessary war. I think that most people view that skirmish over those piles of bird-infested rock as just strutting. I don't think that anyone really believes that it's not even the Falklands that anyone would actually go to war over it. And I think that it's an interesting point that, you know, this is about China asserting itself and Japan protecting itself, and these are squabbles. China, they're not stupid, the Chinese. They're incredibly smart and savvy. But they, you know, these things have agendas which may not be readily apparent. And I think that those guano-infested rocks are not about war. They're just about sort of greater China.
Is it just about the rocks, Tim, or are there other things in play as well?
Well, I go back to what I said about a 10-year phase of China having to win 6 out of 10 diplomatic crises that erupt or are erupt by design, and they will. And neither side can be seen to back down on these islands because, you know, it is, as we've agreed, not about the rocks. It's about whose backyard or whose sea is the East China Sea. Americans patrol it and keep the sea lanes open for everybody. The Japanese say, well, it's obviously our backyard. The Chinese say it's obviously our backyard. And it is all about how to manage that relationship. But China is going to be the greatest power in that area. All the countries, including Japan, know that I think California is 6,000 miles away and Beijing is a few hundred miles away. And that's a pretty powerful thing. So it's about much more than the rocks. It's about the relationship of the entire two seas, the East China Sea, South China Sea, and the mineral deposits and the gas that's supposed to be, and the oil that's all supposed to be down there. And you have to stake your claim. This is mine. And you do it through a number of ways, including changing perception.
And I think that the rising China is actually an interesting contrast to you know, there you've got Obama, who you know, was triumphantly in China, was it 2009? Yeah.
Triumphant Obama seems a long time ago, doesn't it?
Well, and that's my point. Times continue to change, and you know, a theme that is constant around this table is the limits of superpower power. And I think, you know, what you're seeing is a restrained Obama, maybe by disposition, but also by the politics of America. And you're seeing an ascendant China. And, you know, we're seeing a counterbalancing. We're witnessing a counterbalancing.
I think part of that counterbalance is the very fact that we are talking about the Japanese-Chinese relationship. Now, normally in these great big summits, you know, it's Obama this, Obama that, and the relationship with China. We're actually focusing on the equally important relationship that is there. On Obama, it's very interesting where he's going next. He's going off to Myanmar, Burma, because China and America are battling for Burma at the moment, who will have the most influence. And then he's going on to Australia to reassure the Australians, don't worry, we've got 150 Marines there now, we might have some more. So, you know, he's engaged in his own game, and key to that, Malacca Straits. 40%, I think it is, of China's energy needs come through the Malacca Straits. Sitting each side of it, Singapore, Malaysia, US allies. So again, this thing about perception. America has to keep saying to all the countries, don't worry, we're going to stand by you. China has to keep saying to them, have you seen how far away America is? Why don't you start to come into our zone of influence? And the handshake with the Japanese Prime Minister is all part of who's the big boy in town.
Which is where we came in, I guess, and where we shall move on. Because on the subject of intractable diplomatic disputes, talks in Oman between Iran, the United States and the European Union have entered an unscheduled second day today. A deadline for a deal is now just 2 weeks away, but the essence of the dispute is as it ever was. Iran insists its nuclear program is altogether peaceful in intention and nobody else believes them. Jeffrey, how much would you be willing to bet that 2 weeks from today, hats will be being hurled in the air as the world celebrates a definitive agreement between Iran and the rest of the planet over its nuclear ambitions?
Not much more than the coins in my pocket. I think that there's just no sign of progress. I think Kerry, what did Kerry say today? We're working hard. We're working hard, which is, you talk about garbled diplomatic speech a moment ago. I mean, you know, we're working hard says about nothing, doesn't it?
Well, working hard. I mean, we do get a regular education in diplomatic speak in this studio from John Everard, our former man in North Korea. I think working hard, that's not as serious as full and frank exchange,
no.
Is it?
Oh, no.
No, I mean, because that means
they had the row.
Yeah. Well, yeah, someone has right to mop up the blood afterwards. Yeah. Tim, would you be investing heavily in the prospect of a deal being signed 2 weeks from right now?
No, but I'd be investing heavily in that this is all part of the extraordinarily slow rapprochement between the two, which probably will end up, whether it's next year or in 5 years, with the two countries being friends again, but not in the next 2 weeks. But they've got to come up with a form of words in 2 weeks by the deadline, which allows them then to keep talking. You know, it's this forever extending the deadline. Because if you've got a deadline and you cross it and you haven't achieved what you said, well, where do you go from there? So Kerry will indulge in some more diplo-speak, as we call it, in a couple of weeks, allowing it to look as if they have made some progress on some of the key issues, but they didn't quite get there, and so they're going to need to keep talking. I cannot believe that either side will break it off because the stakes are too high.
And I think it goes back to the point we were just making about China and Japan. It's about playing to the home audience, particularly for Iran. I mean, I think it's less important for the Americans and the Europeans because it's, well, it's an important issue. It's not a major, an A-level issue. But I think for the Iranians, they've got to be very careful to play, particularly to the conservative constituency in Iran that is hostile to rapprochement with the West. And so this kind of brinksmanship in many ways sets up a tension that protects their posteriors, so to speak.
On the subject of that brinkmanship, though, is that basically the problem? And I guess you could say the same about Japan and China, that the two sides now have such entrenched positions that they can't be seen, especially the Iranians, to concede anything without looking like they have capitulated to the great Satan. Is this all about trying to find some form of words that allows Iran to come back in without looking like it's given up?
Well, I think it is all that. I think there's another subtext to this, and I think it's one that's complex to explore. But I think the unraveling in the Arab world and the tensions, the rising Sunni extremism, does change the dynamic for relationship with Shiite-dominated Iran, and so there is a different equation going on a level completely apart from the nuclear talks, and bringing Iran into the fold would help. In terms of trying to create some sort of order or sanity in that region. And so I think there is an incentive for the Americans and the Europeans to try to build bridges.
It's a different level, but it informs the nuclear talks. You know, what is happening in Iraq with the Iranians and the letter that Obama allegedly sent to the Iranians, it informs these talks and it allows them to realize, you know what, we've got stuff to talk about as well as this nuclear deal. As I understand it, it's still the issue of sovereignty. Can you or can you not spin uranium yourself? Do you have to ship some of it out, which is a sovereign issue? We have every right, say the Iranians, to spin our own uranium. And when you get to those technical details, it really gets tough.
It does become extremely arcane very quickly. But obviously one participant in this argument who is not present in Iran is Israel. To what extent does their opinion or their view of this still have, I guess, an impact? And Jeffrey, I'll ask you this fun question first, because isn't it the case that ultimately Israel will decide that it will act in its own self-defense if it feels it has no other option? Because that's what Israel always does.
Well, yes, but I think even Israel in its rashness is going to be very careful about hurling bombs at Iran. I mean, I think that they might do some was it Stuxnet? Was that
the computer virus
that shut down Iran? I mean, if that can be traced to Israel, that kind of espionage, yes. But I think open warfare, no. And the Israelis and a few selective assassinations thought to be by the Israelis of key nuclear figures in Iran. I mean, that's the way they operate. They're much more cunning, if we're to believe what we're reading, which does sound a lot like a Graham Greene novel. But they're not. I think that they would continue to operate at that level, not at the level of sending missiles.
Tim, you mentioned there the idea of a some sort of rapprochement between the United States and Iran, and it's by no means impossible. Things do change, as we will be discussing fairly shortly vis-a-vis Berlin. But what kind of timescale do you think we're looking at there? I mean, what I'm asking is, when can you imagine that what I believe, if I recall from my visit correctly, is currently advertised as the Museum of U.S. Espionage and whatever it is they call it in Tehran, is reopened?
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Is fascinating, yeah. But is reopened as the embassy of the United States. How far off that are we, do you think?
Oh, at least 5 years. But, you know, between that and now, there are a number of things, and one is a nuclear deal, another one is an understanding that they have a common interest in taking on Islamic State and any other Sunni Islamist fundamentalism. And if you can get over that, you can start having pacts, you can start lifting sanctions, you can start having trade agreements, which can lead to an exchange of, a cultural center, which can lead to an exchange of a low-level envoy, which, you know, it's all stepping stones, but it always has to start with an agreement. And in a way, it started, and that is them working together in Iran. I mean, in Iraq, you know, they're not working on boots on the ground or, you know, charging forward with fixed bayonets together, but they are aware of each other's activities, turning a blind eye to it and sending messages to each other via the Iraqis.
On that semi-optimistic note, we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Tim Marshall and Jeffrey Kaufman. When we return, we'll be looking to Berlin and the echoes of the Cold War playing out in geopolitics today, 25 years on.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Broadcasting around the clock from our headquarters at Midori House in London, Monocle 24 is the global radio service of Monocle magazine and a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content. With bureau in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Istanbul, Zurich, New York and Toronto, and a network of over 35 correspondents, Monocle 24 is edited by Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. If you have any editorial, programming or advertising inquiries, please contact us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Tim Marshall, diplomatic editor with Sky News, and Jeffrey Kaufman, the journalist and commentator. Now, 25 years ago from approximately right now, the people of West and East Berlin were completing their first day's work, tearing down the wall that had divided their city for 28 years. It had been broached the previous evening after a communist bureaucrat named Gunther Schabowski fluffed his lines at a press conference and effectively declared the Cold War over. Recent events in Ukraine especially pose the question, could the West have afforded to be a little more gracious in victory? We will get to that presently, but Jeffrey, I'll ask you first, what was your where I was and what I thought moment about the Berlin Wall coming down?
Gosh, I was working for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and I was not, I was a domestic national correspondent at the time, and I was really jealous. I remember I was in Toronto, and I had not risen to the ranks of foreign correspondent, and I thought, darn, this is as good as a story in history gets. And I remember watching it on the monitors in the newsroom saying
Dateline envy, it is a terrible thing.
It's okay. I got my share of great international stories, but that was sort of, I think, you know, you have to kind of, yeah, you have to really want it. And boy, when it was fascinating, and it was just so unexpected. I just remember that sense of, you know, when you're young and the Cold War is just part of the lexicon of your life, and you know, it just, you just assume that it was going to go on forever. And I'm probably, you don't have to be young, I suppose, people who are older.
People do, I think, you know, both as individual human beings and as societies, people live in a permanent present, and then something extraordinary happens which completely upends it. I mean, yeah, it seemed to me, I remember you watching from Sydney, it seemed absolutely bizarre, but 25 years on, the idea that it was accepted that half of Europe was a prison camp just seems, you know, actually even more weird than that. Tim, where were you at the time? Were you suffering Dateline envy?
Extraordinarily Dateline envy. Well, actually, with much respect to Canada, I was actually living in Paris at the time. I was a correspondent in Paris. But, you know, being stuck in Paris,
that's even more painful. Yeah.
that's just a train ride.
Exactly. And not going. But I listened to it on the radio. And as we all know, the pictures are better on radio. It really was fantastic radio I was listening to. And the very next day, I was on the Champs-Élysées and a Trabant turned up. The old East German car. The first thing they'd done was jump in their car, drove all night, all day, and then drove up the Champs-Élysées for that taste of, this is what the outside world looks like.
But, you know, it's funny you say it, because I'm getting goosebumps. You say radio. I'm a big fan of radio, too, and I agree that radio has better pictures often. But I do remember so vividly those images of people on top of the wall, yeah, celebrating, champagne, hugging. And that really, in a world that has so much pessimistic, negative news, that really was one of the most exhilarating images.
Is this the right time to say that, and then from that led to the Yugoslav wars, and et cetera,
well,
et cetera?
Well, indeed. We're not to
mention the current issues in the Ukraine.
Exactly. And Georgia.
In Ukraine.
Which we will now get to. Although I didn't get to Berlin myself until about a year later as a clueless Australian with a backpack, but it was still possible.
I did too. Did you chip a little piece
of
the backpack?
Exactly.
I have it framed.
They want it back, you know.
Yeah. It was still possible to rent a hammer and chisel, yeah, and have a whack at the bits of the wall, yeah, that were still standing, yeah, which was immensely satisfying. Mikhail Gorbachev attending the commemorations in Berlin this week. Weirdly, he doesn't get invited to much in Russia anymore. But he said that the West had, as he put it, succumbed to triumphalism. Is he right, Jeffrey? I'll ask you first.
Yeah, I think he is right. But can I first of all say that when I saw the pictures of him, he's been so out of the news. It was quite shocking, yeah, to see. He's a decrepit old man.
Yeah, he got old. He's 83 now.
Yeah, right? And it's you know, he's so frozen in time in those images, mm, from 1989 that you, I actually, oh my gosh, he's alive still. You know, he's been so off the radar. But yeah, I do think the triumphalism is part of the issue that we're having with Putin right now. That the annexation of the former Soviet satellite states is, you know, it continues to rub salt in the wound, and I think that the West underestimated how much and how offensive that would be for the Russians, the former Soviets.
But I guess, Tim, to ask you the same question a different way, obviously all the former Eastern European nations, apart from Russia, and I travelled across Eastern Europe, mm, as a clueless Australian with a backpacker in 1990, and it was astonishing. But all of these countries couldn't join the West and the EU fast enough. Yeah. What is it about Russia?
How long have we got?
That's the name of a book,
well,
I'm sure.
Well, you've got about 90 seconds if you're lucky.
Well, I mean, we all know the history, and that's what it's about. And yes, they couldn't wait to join either or EU and NATO, in some occasions both of them, because that's where most of their trouble has come from. And also, it was part of a Russian empire. I do think we were a bit triumphal. I do think that we underestimated the idea of NATO coming right up to its borders at a time when the Russians claim that NATO said it wouldn't, but that's never been proven. Nevertheless, you know, I'm not a self-hating Westerner, and you've got to turn it around and think, well, hang on, what did they do wrong? All those countries and the majority of their populations chose, and they chose to look one direction. Mm-hmm. They did not choose to look east. So what are we supposed to do? Abandon them the way we did in Poland in 1939?
Which is also, I guess, is the other
obvious
question.
Well, we're doing question. That in Ukraine, so... Yeah.
Up to a point. Yeah. It's got a Western-looking government now that knows it's got to pay its gas bills eastwards.
But really, what else could we have done? I mean, you've thrown Russia a couple of the Baltic states to keep them happy. I mean...
In NATO.
Tim makes a valid point. But you have to... You know, I think that Gorbachev's point is... appearing triumphant. It may not have been an aggressive design. It may be that Latvia and Poland, as we believe, really wanted to rush into the arms of the West. But you can understand why the great empire feels wounded.
Obama called Russia last year a second-rate power. Now, maybe it is, but you don't need to say that.
Especially not to Russia.
Stick a stick in the Russian bay. You just don't need to do it. I don't think they've played it particularly well. On the other hand, I do come back to this thing. What are you supposed to do? All these countries looked in a certain direction. You can't refuse them.
You could argue, indeed, I guess, that the Soviets lost the Cold War when they put the wall up. When you actually have to build a fence to stop everybody leaving, you've kind of lost the argument.
That's your version, comrade.
We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. Jeffrey Kaufman and Tim Marshall, thank you both, as ever, very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tóquio.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Lots still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be heading to Athens to check in with our correspondent there, and we'll talk to Azar Nafisi about her new book, The Republic of Imagination. Ahead of all that, Paul Osborne has the headlines.
The UN's condemning an attack on a school in the northeast of Nigeria in which at least 48 people were killed. 79 others were injured. Police say the attacker was disguised as a student. The bomb went off as pupils had gathered for an assembly. A woman's been stabbed to death in the West Bank hours after an Israeli soldier was badly injured in another knife attack in Tel Aviv. The woman was attacked near a Jewish settlement to the south of Jerusalem. The attacker was shot by a security guard. The leaders of Albania and Serbia have argued publicly about the status of Kosovo after talks that were meant to signal a new era in relations between them. Adi Rama was the first Albanian prime minister in Belgrade for nearly 70 years, but at a news conference he called on Serbia to formally recognise Kosovo's independence, something described as a provocation by the Serbian prime minister. And a memorial service has taken place in Amsterdam 4 months after a Malaysia Airlines plane was shot out of the sky over the east of Ukraine. Almost two-thirds of the nearly 300 people on board were from the Netherlands. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, 16:33 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents, and we're heading to Athens, where Natalie Savarikas awaits. Natalie, earlier in the show, we were talking about tensions in the South China Sea between Japan and China. There's kind of a similar row brewing over the Aegean Sea, or at least more than usual.
Yes, indeed. Essentially, what's been happening is over the much-coveted oil and gas that is allegedly under the Aegean Sea close to Cyprus. And it seems now that tensions have been arising between Turkey and Cyprus, as Turkey now also wants to start exploring the area, as the island has essentially been divided for decades between the northern part and the southern, so where Turkey has its also its interest, and that's essentially what's been heating up lately. And Greece has also been involved, obviously, in this case. Now, what has happened is that Turkey has sent over its navy ships to protect the vessels that were exploring for all sorts of hydrocarbons. And that has raised a lot of eyebrows in Greece, and the media has gone absolutely ballistic over it, especially after Sunday's recent announcement of the head of the Turkish Navy, who announced that the rules of engagement are currently changing in Greece. The way that they engage with the other Navy ships will be changing.
Is this a concern that genuinely arouses real passion among the Greek public, or is it sort of an obsession of the governing classes and the media, as these things quite often are?
I think it's quite—it's a bit of both. Of course, the media have been always has been obsessing over Turkey's latest actions and whether they've been dispatched big Navy vessels, etc. Whereas in Turkey, they won't even blink an eyelid over all these concerns. But of course, at the beginning of December, what we're having is the Turkish Prime Minister himself, Ahmet Davutoğlu, who will be visiting Athens to hold talks with the Greek Premier, Antonis Samaras. It's all quite, suspicious. They will be discussing all the cooperation between both countries. And of course, this will be high on the agenda.
Okay, well, moving along to some slightly happier news. Greece, despite having a bad few years in many respects, has had a bumper year for tourism. Why is that? Is it just that people sort of read the stories about Greece's economy and think that there's a bargain to be had?
Well, indeed, one of this is that, but also because for the past years, because of the financial crisis, Greece had suffered tremendously, had, all we've been seeing were like crazy protests and riots in the streets, and tourists were very much preferring other calmer destinations where no strikes would be, intruding on their holidays in the sun. So Greece has always been relying on tourism as a steady stream of income, and that had been affected because of the crisis these years. So the government of Antonis Samaras has decided to change its course and invest much more in rebuilding the Greek image abroad. And they're reaping the rewards, as we're saying. We're expecting some 23 million visitors this year alone. And considering the country's total population is 11 million, it's quite an important amount. And just in the first half of the year alone, we're seeing receipts of 4 billion euros coming in. So for that strapped country, it's pretty impressive numbers.
Well, one of the things those tourists could be going to, of course, is a new photo exhibition at the Banaki Museum. It's billed as a Depression-era photo exhibition, which, of course, in most countries would conjure up images of people walking across the Oklahoma Dust Bowl in the 1920s, but a collection of Greek Depression-era photographs, they're really only a few years old.
Yeah, quite. And what's impressive about this is that there are so many facets to the Greek crisis, so many little details that we have left behind when we're just covering about, the finances of this whole turmoil, this economic turmoil that has been going on for the past now 5 years nearly. And all these little details have cut deep in the psyche of the people living in this country. And that's exactly what over 30 artists have tried to show through their individual works, whether it's on healthcare, education, immigration, or even how public sector interiors can actually show the soul of the Greek culture and identity. And that is exactly what is so rich about this exhibition that is hosted at the Banaki Museum.
Does the fact that this era is being collected and collated into an exhibition, does it suggest any belief among Greek people, or at least the people who put this exhibition together, that that this is now part of history and that the worst may be over?
That is a big question mark. It is for most of them. This is a reminder of what happened and what could continue happening if the political establishment doesn't take the decisions that need to be taken to reverse what we've been seeing for the past 4 years. No, for sure, Greeks do not think that the worst you know, is behind them, especially those that were forced to, let's say, go back to live with their parents in the mid-40s because they can't afford their rent or their, you know, their lifestyle anymore. Or for the people who are now forced to live in the streets, which is a completely shocking and new phenomenon for this Mediterranean country where, you know, no one was left in the streets. So if you speak to them, for sure the worst isn't over. And this is what's so important about this Depression era exhibition. It's a strong reminder to all of the rest of Greeks who might be slowly coming out of the crisis that, you know, things need to change and mentality need to change to avoid a repetition of this in the future.
Natalie Savarikas in Athens, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll be speaking to Azar Nafisi. Stay tuned.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because dragstar taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, 1842 here in London. Azar Nafisi's first book, the international bestseller Reading Lolita in Tehran, was to a great extent a memoir of taking refuge in Western literature even, and especially as all such decadence was expunged from her native Iran by the 1979 Islamist revolution of Ayatollah Khomeini. Her latest book, The Republic of Imagination, applies a similar approach to her adopted America. Azar Nafisi joins us now from New York. Azar, welcome to the show. First of all, the subtitle of your new book is A Case for Fiction. Why do you think that case needs to be made?
Well, it needs to be made because nowadays, along with, you know, we live in a period of crisis and there are many transitions that we see both in values and in terms of economy and politics. The whole world is in a turmoil, and fiction usually becomes one of, not just fiction, but fiction as representative of the world of imagination and ideas, usually becomes one of the first victims of such a situation.
The starting point of your journey through some American literature is a meeting, I think I'm right in saying, with a reader at a book signing in Seattle who suggested that people in Iran care more about literature than people in America. And it's been my experience traveling to non-Western countries, especially where places where access to culture is limited, that people do value it more. Is a kind of disdain for literature, is it an inevitable consequence of a prosperous, secure country? People don't value it because it's just there.
I think that it is
a result of a complacent and conformist country, more of a secure one. Democracies totalitarian countries have produced great works of literature during times that were not repressive. You could think about England itself. Some of the greatest works out of that country or Europe as a whole have come at times when there were not great wars or revolutions. I think it comes out of a sense of complacency, and I think that Saul Bellow said it well when he said that those who survive the ordeal of Holocaust, will they survive the ordeal of freedom? Sometimes prosperity makes us forget that freedom is an ordeal, and a lot of people have been killed for it, and it is not something that you have been given. It is not God-given, and it needs to be protected. And I think that ideas and imagination have a role as guardians of freedom and of memory.
The Republic of Imagination is organized around three key works of American literature: The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Babbitt, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. How did you come to choose those? Because obviously you're picking three from a very, very wide field.
Yes, and you know, at the beginning I had about 24 books, which I gave in my outline to my editor, who rightly so was absolutely frightened out of her wits. But then I decided that what I want to do, I would not be able to do justice to those books. Rather, I should focus on the themes that I want to focus on, and then choose the kind of books that will address those situations. And one of the things that I wanted to do as well was that these days, at least in America, but I believe that in Europe perhaps from some quarters as well, we're talking about the fact that imagination and ideas are not so relevant to our reality. Actually, they come out of the fact that they say when we are dealing with such big world issues, including the economy and the wars and terror and all of that, how can we talk about books as if they're important to our lives? And what I wanted to do through these books was to show how, in fact, fiction and reality are very interdependent upon one another, and denigration of one is denigration of the other. And right now in the United States, we have this very utilitarian, very ideological point of view that talks about America as being a sort of dog-eat-dog world, that individualism means just materials and crass success and money. We're taking music and art and fiction out of our public schools, replacing it with what we call making students career ready or vocational. And so all of these that are the foundations of a democracy, the values that are the foundations of democracy that these books preserve, are being taken out of our public spheres. Would Mark Twain, I felt that Mark Twain was sort of Huckleberry Finn was the literary declaration of independence by Mark Twain. He created a new perspective on fiction, and he created the moral values that American society should be sort of founded upon, which is an individualism that is connected, that cannot exist except through the eyes of the other. Huck is resurrected through Jim's eyes, and each other novel in this book relates to that fact and finds that conformity is one of the main enemies of a democracy. And conformity, in fact, as we see in Mark Twain and as we see in James Baldwin and others, can become very violent. And this is what we should be paying attention to.
Did it occur to you when you were putting the book together and looking at these books, I guess, afresh to an extent, do you find yourself now reading American literature differently now that you've lived in America for a long time than you did when you'd lived in Iran and sort of seeing America only through the pages of the books?
Well, yes, to an extent, because, you know, when I was in America, I was a student, And I was spending most of my time, apart from reading books and going to school, I was spending the rest of my time protesting against America. but when I came back to America, I found that my protests were rather shallow, and that this critique that I have now of America goes far deeper than talking about CIA agents or American intervention, that in fact the way that our politicians today, both in America and elsewhere, are acting comes from something far more deep-rooted. So when I read these books, I realized that in a sense these books become the moral guardians of American society. You notice that most of the American heroes, like Huck Finn and Jim, are outcasts. They live on the margins of society. For them, in fact, and like our politicians today, material success is nothing. There is a different kind of success, which is very important, and failure sometimes becomes a sense of moral success. They don't want to become kings and queens. They don't want to become presidents. They don't want to become Donald Trump and Bill O'Reilly. They want to be people who are true to their own heart and to their version of what conscience means. And today I feel that those values are very much endangered. And coming from a country like Iran, where fiction created spaces for us, I cannot allow that imagination and ideas be taken so lightly now in my new country.
Azar Nafisi, an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining us. The Republic of Imagination, Azar Nafisi's new book, is available now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's coming up for, well, it is now 18:51. It's time now for our daily art review as we get to the end of the show. Today we're talking art. And joining me now from Sao Paulo is freelance journalist, regular Monocle contributor, Claire Rigby. Claire, welcome to the show. You've been going to see a bunch of things in Rio and Sao Paulo, which we will talk about well, right now, in fact. But I wanted to start with Illusions, an exhibition at Casa Daros.
Yeah, hi, Andrew. Yeah, Illusions is really just, I think, actually I'll probably go as far as saying the show of the year. Absolutely stunning group show at the Rio de Janeiro Casa Daros, which is a really beautiful exhibition space in its own right. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, what were some particular highlights?
Well, it's a Latin American institution, so they specialise in Latin American art. I think some of the outstanding pieces were, there was a whole room by the Uruguayan artist Luis Caminitza. Actually, he was born in Germany but grew up in Uruguay. And his 1970s works really sort of set the tone for the whole exhibition, which was all about art, illusion. They were really fantastic. There was a series, for example, of pieces called Arbitrary Objects and Their Titles, where he paired like bits of plastic or, you know, a scrap of sweet paper with arbitrary titles. And as a viewer, you just constantly find yourself trying to interpret them, where really his point is that there is no interpretation there, but we can't stop looking for it.
That's Illusions at Casa Daros. You've also been to an exhibition at the Visual Art, School of Visual Arts at Parque Lage, which I've almost certainly just hideously mispronounced. This exhibition commemorates the first 4 years of the school, which was 1975 to 79. What was special about that period?
Well, it was a really important period in Brazilian art, for a start. It was at the height of the dictatorship also, so that a lot of the stuff that they were doing there at Parque Lage, which you pronounced perfectly, it was very night. Well, the exhibition's fascinating because, first of all, it's very 1970s. They're all kind of groovy, kind of, you know, Rio de Janeiro artists of the 70s. Lee jeans everywhere and long hair, doing kind of performance art. And, you know, it was a period that gave rise to some of the most interesting artists. And, in fact, in the 80s, there was a very important show at Parque Lage, which featured some of the artists who'd been studying there in the 70s and had sort of gone on to be some of the most important artists in Brazil.
Another exhibition in Sao Paulo. This is the Ana Maria Maiolino exhibition at Galleria Luisa Strina. The first most obvious question to ask about this is why it has taken until now to stage what I think I'm right in saying is her first solo exhibition.
Oh, I'm not sure that it is her first solo exhibition. I'd be really surprised.
Sure, I read that somewhere. I may be making that up, but I'm pretty sure I read that somewhere.
Yeah. Well, you may be right. That would be really astonishing. I mean, I think it would be horrific, actually. She's an incredible artist. She's been working since the 1960s. She's 72 years old now. I actually interviewed her a few weeks ago at her studio here in São Paulo. Wonderful, wonderful woman. Not particularly well known outside Brazil. Another artist, I think, a bit like Kamenitsa, she was born in Italy and emigrated to Brazil as a very young woman with her family. She has an incredible, incredible body of work in clay, sculpture, most mediums actually, but the clay stuff is the stuff I really love.
On further research, I realise it's the first solo exhibition she's had with Galleria Luisa Strina, so I was half right, and that's literally all that matters. What do we learn from this exhibition about how her work has evolved over the five decades it encompasses?
Going back to clay, I think, is really one of the interesting things, and she talks a lot about that, how she started working with clay in the 1990s, I think. She first started working with it as just a kind of sort of transitional material. She was making sculptures that clay was one of the phases in making the moulds, and she just became very passionate about it. She produced an enormous body of work in unfired clay, including at Documenta in, I think, 2012, where she just covered every single surface of a house with these incredible shapes in unfired clay. And then in the works in this current exhibition at Luisa Strina, there's a lot of works in fired clay, in raku ceramic. So that was one of the interesting, I think, progressions in what she's doing.
Okay, and finally we proceed to the White Cube in Sao Paulo, which is conducting an exhibition of Damien Hirst's work, Black Scalpel Cityscapes, in which he has, for reasons certainly surpassing my understanding, assembled a bunch of aerial cityscapes constructed from surgical equipment.
Exactly. I mean, we're not sure quite why that might be, but actually, I have to say, they're really quite striking. He's done, I think, 17 cities, actually, as he says, either sites of conflict or centres of economic political significance. And he's basically, I mean, I think using Google Maps or something similar, has just kind of constructed the layouts of them in razor blades, kind of spray-painted black. It's kind of odd, sort of juvenile kind of collage sort of thing look to it with the black paint. But, they're pretty striking. They're pretty impactful as pieces of art as well.
It's a lot less garish than a lot of his work. I mean, by definition of the fact that it is just black and white, does it seem slightly more serious? A lot of the time it's very hard to tell whether Damien Hirst actually has a point or not, or if indeed the very fact that he doesn't have a point actually is the point.
I think you're right. That's true, actually. They do look a little bit more sombre and a bit more sober than some of his work. He was actually at the exhibition. He was at the opening on Saturday. And I think he said to the local paper, the Folia, he never really goes to exhibitions in London. He never goes to openings because people are kind of sort of harangue him, really, I think. Whereas here in São Paulo, he was quite happy to appear. He posed for loads of photos. He was saying that he gave a very interesting interview to Folia, and he was saying how it got to a point with his work where people were selling his pieces on without even opening the box. So collectors were buying the pieces, not even opening them or displaying them, selling them on to somebody else who also never opened the boxes. He says nobody was actually looking at the work. So I thought that's kind of poignant and also quite funny because it does make you wonder what was in the boxes, if it really was.
Claire Rigby in Sao Paulo, thank you very much for joining us with that roundup of the art scene. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Jeffrey Kaufman and Tim Marshall. Today's show is produced by Daniel Giacopelli and Alice Block, researched by David Pleasant and Max Koshik. Our studio manager was Joel Church. After the headlines is The Culture Show with Robert Bound at 2200. It's the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.